United States government.
This is VOA News. By remote, I'm Tommy McNeil. Security forces in Myanmar opened fire and made mass arrests Sunday as they sought to break up protests against the military seizure of power. A UN human rights official said it had credible information that at least 18 people were killed, 30 were wounded. That would be the highest single-day death toll among protesters who are demanding the elected government of Aung San Suu Kyi be restored to power after being ousted by a February 1st coup. About 1,000 people are believed to have been detained Sunday alone, adding to others detained earlier, including Suu Kyi. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres and U.S. officials, including Secretary of State Antony Blinken, have condemned the violence. The Biden administration said Sunday it remains open to talks with Iran over the 2015 nuclear deal, despite Tehran's rejection of an EU invitation to join a meeting with the U.S. and other original participants in that agreement. A senior administration official said the U.S. was disappointed in the rejection, but was flexible as to the timing and format of the talks and saw Iran's decision to snub the European invitation as part of the diplomatic process. The official said the U.S. would be consulting with other participants, that's Britain, China, France, Germany, Russia, and the European Union, on the way forward. The official was not authorized to discuss the matter by name and spoke on condition of anonymity. Earlier Sunday, Iran turned down the offer for talks, saying the time is not ripe for the meeting, at which the U.S. would have participated as an observer. Iran had been insisting that the U.S. lift or ease sanctions imposed on it by the Trump administration. This is VOA News. A U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention advisory panel endorsed the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, voting overwhelmingly to recommend the shot for adults older than 18. CDC recommendations are not binding but are widely respected by medical institutions and professionals. CDC Director Rochelle Walensky later approved the panel's recommendations. Sunday's CDC endorsement came one day after the U.S. Food and Drug Administration formally authorized the use of the one-dose vaccine. Nearly 4 million doses of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine will be distributed and available as early as Tuesday morning, according to a senior administration official. This vaccine, the third to be approved for use in the U.S., will be distributed to states, tribes, and territories proportional to their populations, the same way Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna vaccines have been distributed. India is expanding its COVID-19 vaccination drive beyond healthcare and frontline workers, offering the shots to older people and those with medical conditions that put them at risk. Those now eligible include people older than 60 as well as those over 45 who have ailments such as heart disease or diabetes that make them vulnerable to serious illness. The shots will be given for free at government hospitals and sold at a fixed price at over 10,000 private hospitals. Prime Minister Narendra Modi was among the first inoculated and appealed for everyone to do so. The rollout of the vaccine campaign has been sluggish and virus cases are rising again after months of decline. Israel on Sunday announced plans to vaccinate tens of thousands of Palestinians who work inside Israel and its West Bank settlements. This is at a time of vast disparities in access to vaccines between the Israeli and Palestinian populations. Israel has launched one of the world's most successful vaccination programs, including over half of its population in just 2 months, but it has come under international criticism for not sharing its vaccine stockpile with the Palestinians and the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip, even as it plans to share surplus vaccines with far-flung allies in Africa, Europe, and Latin America. Again, Israel announcing plans to vaccinate tens of thousands of Palestinians who work inside Israel and its West Bank settlement. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, the first day of March. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Nigeria's opposition calls on President Buhari to lead from the front in the fight against kidnapping.
Mr. President assured Nigerians in 2015 that he will lead from the front. But today, it can't be fun. Nigerians are at the mercy of bandits, invaders, and terrorists.
Cameroon separatists accused government forces of attack on the town of Kumbo. Talks in Abuja to salvage Gambia's rejected draft constitution have failed. UNHCR appeals for millions of dollars for Central African Republic refugees. And Niger's losing presidential candidate demands the release of political prisoners.
Mohamed Ousmane reaffirmed that he won the election, and the arrest made in the ranks of his supporters are intended to prevent him from proving this, he said.
And starting a nature and climate sovereign bond facility for debt relief. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's post are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Nigeria's main opposition, the People's Democratic Party, the PDP, has called on President Muhammadu Buhari to adopt a wholesome approach that would end wave of kidnappings in the country. This followed the release over the weekend of 27 boys who were kidnapped last week from their school in Niger State. In reacting to the release, President Buhari assured Nigerians that over 300 girls abducted from Zamfara State would be the last to be kidnapped. Kola Olubondia, the National Publicity Secretary of the PDP, says Nigerians are tired of empty promises.
In Kagara, Niger State, the schoolboys that were abducted have been released. However, what is the modality of their release? How was it achieved? As we speak, the girls that were taken in Changebe in Zamfara State are yet to be released. And it will interest you to know that in the situation in Zamfara, there are allegations of complicity on the part of the military, which the People's Democratic Party has asked the federal government to begin an inquest, which the federal government has refused to speak on. So for us in the People's Democratic Party, we believe that the situation goes beyond the undertaking underhand measures and below-the-bench approaches. We think that the federal government should adopt a total measure that will combat the vice.
President Muhammadu Buhari had a Senate delegation to Zamfara State. As you know, the girls that were abducted sometime ago this month have still not been released. But the president has said that the abduction of these girls and the boys will be the last in Nigeria. Any comment?
For us, the People's Democratic Party, we are used to such promises, which at the end of the day become empty because they have never achieved purposes. So it is not strange to hear Mr. President saying this will be the last abduction, or Mr. President saying, oh, Boko Haram will be defeated in such a number of days. These are empty boasts as far as we are concerned in the People's Democratic Party. And we have demanded that Mr. President should seek help in the management of the sorry situation in which our nation has found herself. It is not enough to reside in the presidential villa in Asoro, in the comfort zone, and be making promises. Mr. President assured Nigerians in 2015 that he will lead from the front, but today it can't be found. Nigerians are at the mercy of bandits, invaders, and terrorists.
The president said that new measures have been put in place that will prevent any further abduction or kidnapping.
The same level of delegation led by the chief of staff to Mr. President was sent to Kaduna State either on Thursday or on Friday to meet with the 19 northern governors and meet with the traditional rulers. A few hours after that meeting, 317 girls were abducted in Changebe in Zamfara State. What Nigerians are demanding today is that Mr. President should show enough cause to empathize with Nigerians, should be seen as leading the people and leading from their fronts, should be sympathetic to the cause and the feelings of the ordinary people out there. It is not enough to hide inside a presidential villa and be making promises.
It's a pleasure to talk with you always, and thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Debre.
Kola Olubodinya is the National Publicity Secretary of Nigeria's main opposition, People's Democratic Party. You are speaking with us from the capital, Abuja. The losing candidate in Niger's presidential runoff election, former President Mahamat Usman, has broken his silence since losing the runoff to Mohamed Bazoum. Journalist Abdul Razak in the capital Niamey says Mahama has called for the release of his supporters.
Mahama and Usman reaffirmed that he won the election, and the arrest made in the ranks of his supporters are intended to prevent him from proving this, he said, but he will go all the way. He also called for the recount of the votes and the end to the arrest and intimidation of opposition activists. He also demanded the immediate release of all those arrested.
Former President Mahama Usman called on the international community not to recognize the results of the runoff election. But did he also tell the protesters to stop their protest?
Addressing to the international community, he challenged it on the risk of worsening of the situation. For him, this situation is still manageable and controllable if the votes cast by the citizen are faithfully reflected in the result.
Who are some of the political prisoners whose release Usman is calling for?
Among those arrested and whose release Mahamat Usman is calling for, we have the leader of the opposition of the current regime, Mr. Hamamadou, the former prime minister and former president. We have Mr. Hamamadou, a former prime minister and former president of the National Assembly. He was formally accused by the Minister of the Interior of being the instigator of the protest. The minister had even said that Mr. Hamamadou was on the run, and it was the day after the minister declaration that Mr. Hamamadou surrendered himself to the judicial police. He is still there without any charge being notified, according to his lawyer. Among also the people arrested and whose release Mahamat Usman is asking for, we also have a former Army Chief of Staff, General Mumuni Borema. We also have a candidate for the last presidential election, Mr. Jibril Barime Nassara. He is the big brother of a former president of the Republic, Mr. Ibrahim Barry Menasara.
Journalist Abdul Razak speaking with us in the Nigerian capital, Niamey. Talks in Abuja, Nigeria to salvage Gambia's rejected draft constitution have failed as the opposition and the government failed to reach a consensus. This followed negotiations by former Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan to help mediate between the disputed parties. Also, over the weekend, Gambia's People's Progressive Party, the PPP, held a chaotic congress where a female member of parliament who lost the election had a row with her opponent. Pandere Umbai has been following these developments from Raleigh, North Carolina, USA.
The Abuja talks collapsed amid lack of consensus among party leaders, according to Sehu Mbalo, the deputy presidential youth advisor. Mbalo says the retroactive clause of the constitution was the main bone of contention at the Abuja talks. The retroactive clause prevents President Barrow from running for more than two terms in office. That never go down well with his supporters. Parliament rejected the draft, saying it was meant to deny President Barrow his current five-year mandate.
I think this further supports the suggestion that this constitution is a UDP constitution and is Usainu Dabo's constitution. That's why he is an obstacle for it, because he doesn't want certain things that majority of Gambians wants to be done.
Almost all the parties were willing to accommodate the president's quest to exclude his current term from the draft, but the opposition UDP disagrees. UDP opposes any changes to be effected on the draft constitution. Pasamba Jau is a Gambian political analyst.
The foundation of the talks itself was the most problematic. Because definitely, if you look at it, what I believe happened, I don't think there was any sincerity in these talks. I think this is nothing but an avenue to try to save face.
The European Union and other Western powers have been calling on the Barrow government to pass the draft constitution. Such calls were ignored by the MPs. Jau said some of the MPs had even told the West to mind its business and stop meddling into Gambia's domestic politics.
Their argument was, this is a national affair and constitutional building. In building our constitution, we do not need interference from foreign powers. So for only the government, the same people turn around and now bring a Goodluck Jonathan and ask him to mediate between political leaders. And part of the other issue that we must ask ourselves is the people who gathered at the Abuja conference, they have no powers to make any changes to anything. The only body that is able to change anything in that draft is the National Assembly.
In another development, Gambia's oldest political party, the People's Progressive Party, PPP, had a chaotic congress over the weekend. One of the female candidates vying for the party's leadership, Tuma Njai, suddenly walked away from the congress, alleging corruption against the party. Keba Jallo is the newly elected leader of the party.
The congress was so transparent. In fact, I think the difficulty she had was she was never in touch with any PPP militant throughout the country. She was disconnected completely from the whole country. Tuma has never set foot until this few recent 1 or 2 months in any constituency.
Jallo has denied the corruption allegations.
I don't have that money to give to Gambia to vote for me anyway. I really don't need that. So this was just brought the question of corruption. But I can tell you, I have never given $1 to anybody to vote for me.
Jallo says Thomas' conduct was reprehensible. He has called on the MP for Banjul South to apologize to the party for what he called for her hostile conduct. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Pan Derimbai reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, the first day of March. Cameroon separatists have accused government forces of attacking the town of Kumbo in the Bouy division of the country. But some observers say the separatists initiated the fight with improvised explosive devices. Chris Anu is the Secretary of State for Communication of the self-proclaimed Republic of Ambazonia.
Last week, French Cameroon government held a security meeting in which they discussed storming the county that we call Bouy. Bouy is in the savannah zone of Ambazonia, and Kumbo happened to be one of the chief towns, or call it cities, in Ambazonia, and Ambazonia also has one of the strongest fighters in that community. And so last week, the French Cameroon government held a meeting in which they have now invaded the entire county with thousands upon thousands of soldiers, and they are moving village to village, attacking people, civilians, in the name of Ambazonia fighters. That is what is going on there now. They have now instructed all senior government officials to stay away from the county while they go around to do this. Until this operation is over, and we do not know when it is going to be over.
Chris, why would the Cameroon military just start attack your forces or attack the people? Did your forces provoke the Cameroon military?
Our forces did not provoke them. James, you will recall that we have been in war with La République du Cameroun for 4 years and counting now. Last week, our forces in that community left for some severe damage on the forces of La République du Cameroun and their equipment. So we are not surprised at this move. It is a counter move. However, the problem is that they are not targeting our fighters. They are targeting civilians. That is the major problem here.
If you read human rights reports, they say that there is violence from both the military side and the Ambazonian forces side. Your comment?
Yes, James, the human rights group, they always say that, but the human rights group, they also say that 3,000 people have been killed. Can you imagine that for 4 years, they keep on saying 3,000 people have been killed? But let's assume 3,000 people have been killed. Who are they reporting have killed the 3,000? Government soldiers, not Amazonian soldiers. So the problem is not with Amazonia. The problem is with La Republique du Cameroun.
Chris Anu is the Secretary of State for Communication of the self-proclaimed Republic of Amazonia. He was speaking with us from the U.S. city of Houston in Texas. The United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR, is appealing for $164 million for assistance and protection for nearly 1.5 million Central Africans uprooted by conflict and violence. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Civil conflict in the Central African Republic has uprooted about one-third of the country's population of 4.7 million, most now refugees in neighboring countries. A new wave of violence triggered by December's disputed presidential election in the CAR has added to the nearly 1.3 million refugees in the region. The UN Refugee Agency says 100,000 more people are newly displaced inside CAR. It says another 111,000 people have joined the exodus to neighboring countries. UNHCR spokesman Boris Cheshakov says most of the refugees have gone to the Democratic Republic of Congo. The rest have sought refuge in Cameroon, Chad, and the Republic of the Congo.
New arrivals are reporting grave human rights abuses inside CAR. Our colleagues in Gore and Chad are caring for a 26-year-old refugee mother who was beaten and raped by a rebel with her six-month-old baby by her side after fleeing her home. She is now pregnant as a result of the assault and is receiving medical and psychosocial support from our teams.
The CAR is one of the poorest countries and one of the most underfunded emergencies in the world. The UNHCR says it urgently needs financial contributions to deliver protection and assistance to the rising number of vulnerable people inside the CAR and in host countries. Despite limited resources, Cheshakov says the UNHCR has scaled up border and protection monitoring. He says it also is supporting survivors of sexual violence and helping to mitigate the risk of further gender-based violence.
We're also working to reduce the risk of COVID-19 infections by building and equipping quarantine centers and areas for treatment and isolation, as well as testing, distributing masks, raising awareness on COVID-19 prevention and social distancing by improving water, sanitation, and health resources.
The UNHCR says the situation is particularly challenging in the DRC. It reports many of the 92,000 newly arrived refugees are spread among 40 remote places close to the volatile border. It notes the new arrivals now outnumber the local population. It adds the refugees are living in makeshift shelters without access to vital services such as education and health care. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The group Finance for Biodiversity is starting a nature and climate sovereign bond facility in an effort to address both the sovereign debt crisis worsened by the pandemic in many countries. In the coming months, the group says the facility would help set up deals between debtor and creditor nations that would allow more fiscal space for debtor nations to both address nature and poverty issues. Simon Zadek is chair of Finance for Biodiversity.
In the same situation, a French-Gabon deal, and I'm just inventing the example, it could be a German-Pakistani deal, it could be a UK-Suriname deal, but a deal between two sovereigns could be that the creditor agrees to reduce the interest payments or indeed the principal repayment requirement in return for a commitment of the country to achieve certain agreed nature or climate-related performance outcomes, but the money that's saved by the debtor country, the African country in this case, need not all be spent on achieving those performance outcomes. So it creates, if you like, what technically would be called more fiscal space, which in effect is more money that the government has to spend on other stuff, which obviously in the context of the crisis is critically important. So in the short term, nature performance bonds help to address both problems. Debt relief, reduced capital repayments, fiscal space, allowing them to spend that money in part on an array of real priorities.
Does this give creditors too much power in the relationship between this trying to use finances to conserve nature and allowing sovereign nations to have more fiscal room?
If I owed you $100 and you said, you don't have to repay me the $100, as long as you, treat your family well and do good things in the community. If I then said to you, well, I'm not willing to do that because you've got that kind of power over me, you can imagine what that conversation might look like. Now, obviously, I'm desperately simplifying the point, and power relationships between creditors and debtors are clearly fraught with problems. But the argument that there should be unfettered debt relief perhaps is not right. I'm not pretending that everything is win-win and everybody will agree, but I think I am arguing, and we are arguing, that there are forms of conditionality that will encourage creditors to make deals that reduce the cost of capital repayments. So it's an incentive to creditors, and it will allow debtors to both increase their fiscal space to spend on protecting the poor, for example, or creating jobs, as well as investing more broadly in the longer-term resilience and growth of the country.
That was Simon Zadek, Chair of Finance for Biodiversity. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Amsterdam. Now for Daybreak Africa's Pulse, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with results from the CAF Champions League played across various venues on the continent this past weekend. Wydad Club Athletic moved top of Group C in the Total CAF Champions League with a 4-0 win over Kaizer Chiefs in Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso on Sunday. The victory took the two-time champions to 6 points after their opening day victory over Angola's Petro de Luanda. Chiefs are still winless following an opening day barren draw in Johannesburg against Guinea's Horoya. In Dar es Salaam, Temba Mishishi Ziwane scored a brace as Mamelodi Sundowns beat 10-man CR Belouizdad 5-1 at the National Stadium in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, in their Group B Total African Cup of Nations tie. The victory makes it 2 victories in a row from the 2016 champions, who have now gone to 6 points, opening a 4-point buffer between them and second place TP Mazembe on top of Group B. Staying with football, Ghana and Gambia will face off for the second time at the Total Under 20 African Cup of Nations in Mauritania when the two West African sides clash at the Olympic Stadium in Nouakchott on Monday in the first semi-final. The two teams played against each other in the group stages, where Gambia came from a goal down to beat the Black Satellites 2-1 and earn an automatic spot in the quarterfinals, with Ghana dropping to third but squeezing through as one of the best 2 third-placed teams. In the second semi-final, the Ugandan Hippos will face Tunisia after the East Africans booked a place in the last four following their 5-3 post-match penalties win over a tough Burkina Faso side. Ugandan defender Kenneth Samakula says they are ready for the Tunisia challenge.
We are well prepared. We are ready for the semi-finals, and we hope for positive results. And we should also thank the our fans back home for supporting us.
In women's football, Shilin Boysen, the new head coach of the South Sudan senior women's national team, Bright Satellite, has assumed duties. Boysen, who holds a CAF A license, was recently the performance analyst for South Africa's team at the 2020 COSAFA Women's Championship. She spoke to my colleague James Butte on her vision for the South Africa's senior women's national team.
What is your overall vision for the team?
My overall vision for the team is much connected to the associations. I have a 2-year contract with the association, and I think long term, I know that the vision is to be the best in the CECAFA region. For now, our first task will be to select the most talented players in the country and build a competitive team from there. We want to gain a FIFA ranking as soon as we can within the 2 years and make sure the players get the best experiences playing at the very highest level for their country.
And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, March 1st edition of Daybreak Africa. I'm James Barton, Washington, wishing you a great week.